Welcome to a brand new episode of Backpass with Russ, and I'm delighted I'm not alone presenting the show anymore. I've got my partner, the resident young man, Kelvin. He's broken free from the shackles of work to be here with us once again. He's had his creative, rejuvenation as well over the weekend. So now he's back. Kel, how are you doing? Long time no see.
Creative rejuvenation. That is something that is absolutely true, Russ. Like I feel great. Basically, if anyone who follows Backpass, they know we had our first show, Backpass Talks. We are going live these days for football events, and you know, was a great time at SUTD. You know, trying my best to give the best version of Peter Dury, commentary. And stuff like that, you know, on the mic. So it was really good. Found my mojo again, and I'm happy to be back, Russ.
That's great to hear. How are things in life anyways?
Things are, you know, great. I'm really excited for the guests today. You know, that's one of the main reasons that I'm here
made
today.
Your time for this show, as compared to the other shows, you didn't miss that on purpose, is it?
Some other shows, you know, I wouldn't say anything, but like today's the guest, pretty special, so that's why, you know, I'm here.
Yeah, so let us introduce the guest. You can see him right behind me. He's here as well on the screen if you're watching on YouTube, and representing his beloved West Ham, the first and only West Ham fan on our show so far. Hopefully you get to more West Ham fans in
after
the future.
The Europa Conference League, maybe there might be more now.
Yeah. So anyways, let's introduce to you the guest today. He's an author, a pundit. Oh, wow. What else, Neil? He's also done podcasting. He's also a radio jockey. Yeah, that's an apt description. A man who wears many hats, but he's without a hat today. It's Neil Humphreys. Welcome on to the show, Neil. A pleasure
thank
having
you. Thank
you.
Very kind. I wore my shirt special. This is my West Ham FA Cup final shirt from the year I was born. This is the 1975 FA Cup final jersey. I was born in December 1974. So I've worn this just for you.
Oh, that's so kind of you and very nice. But anyways, just let us know, what was the score in that final though?
What do you mean, what was the score? They won. Of course they won.
That's why you're wearing it.
Well, I say that. They actually played terribly. It's a terrible cup final. I've still got it on DVD over there. It was 1975. They beat Fulham 2-0. And weirdly, Fulham was a second division side then, now the Championship. They were the better team, and they had at centre-back someone called Bobby Moore.
Whoa.
He had left West Ham in pre-season of that year, gets to the cup final, romantic story, underdogs, Fulham, and who does he play? His old team, West Ham, who were terrible, absolutely awful, and yet they won 2-0 because the Fulham goalkeeper dropped two shots through his legs. If you didn't know any better, you would swear he was Kerlong, right? He wasn't, but it was that bad. The mistakes were that bad. He never recovered. So, yeah, victorious in the year I was born. It's been downhill ever since.
Well, that's very nice because it leads up to our first question. You've already mentioned you're a West Ham fan. We've mentioned that as well. But how do you become a West Ham fan?
Well, Rasvinder, as I say this many times in Singapore, it's a law where I grow up that you have to support your local team. Unless, of course, it's Man U, and then it doesn't matter in England because there are more Cockney Red Devils in London than there are in Manchester. But that's another story. But where I grew up, if you're East London, you're West Ham. That's it. My father was West Ham, so I had to be West Ham. It's a law. But that said, my dad, I mean, that's funny in itself. So Bobby Moore, coming back to Bobby Moore, right? Everybody knows Bobby Moore, England's only World Cup winning captain.
Yeah.
Won trophies with West Ham and so on. He had a sports shop opposite Upton Park, West Ham's old stadium, right? Which was literally walking distance from where my father grew up. Yet despite the fact my dad grew up, he doesn't like me telling this story, but despite the fact that he grew up within walking distance of Upton Park, his childhood team was Tottenham, which is the complete effing opposite of being a West Ham fan. They're sworn enemies. But the reason is because, to his defense, you know, when he was a kid, Tottenham were fantastic. They won the double in 1961.
Yeah.
And they had Jimmy Greaves. Jimmy Greaves was a local East London hero who scored, you know, hundreds of goals. Harry Kane has only just beaten his record. He's got a phenomenal record up there with Cristiano Ronaldo. So he supported them because of Jimmy Greaves. When he was 10 years old, my father goes into Bobby Moore's sports shop, and Bobby Moore happened to be there. This was when Bobby Moore was as big as Ronaldo is today in England, right? Bobby Moore happens to be in the shop. He talks to my dad, makes small talk. He says to my dad, "Who do you support?" He said, "Tottenham." He said, "Okay." He said, "Where'd you live?" My dad said, "Forest Gate." He said, "Forest Gate? That's round the corner. You should be West Ham." And from that day, my father supported West Ham because Bobby Moore told him to. How's that for a story?
Oh, yeah, that's fascinating. And we're talking about the 90s and noughties here today. So, of course. Neil, with regards to West Ham, what were your best and worst memories in that era?
Well, it's funny, man, because I was thinking about this because West Ham were mostly crap when I was there. I had a season ticket from 1990 until 1992, and then I went to university in Manchester. And they got relegated in the first 3 years of the 90s. They got relegated twice. They were a yo-yo club, up and down, up and down. And so they were terrible. And yet, my happiest memories of that time, right? Because I was young, I was a teenager. And I was thinking about one of my first games I went to as a season ticket holder was against Aldershot, who were then in the fourth division, now non-league,
okay.
FA Cup. Third round, January, it was -5. It was snow and sleet and everything. It was 0-0, possibly the worst football match in the history of football. And I remember it being so cold in the second half, and I was so fed up and so frozen that I started to pee myself just to warm myself up. Because my legs had frozen. This is not uncommon when you watch English games in the winter back then. This is the old days of stands. This is before all-seater stadiums, right? And I'm a teenager. And if you're 15 years old and you're at the front of the stand because you go in early to get the good spot, right? If you leave to go to the toilet, you don't get back. You don't get back. So frequently you would take bottles with you and pee in the bottle. And I've done that many times at Upton Park, you know, just bottle down there and do what you have to do. Well, this time I didn't have a bottle and I started to half pee myself and it got about as far as my inner thigh. And I thought, no, this is ridiculous. This is, you shouldn't piss yourself at a West Ham game. I mean, come on. So that was 91. They won the replay, but they had a magnificent footballer who played for Manchester City twice, a guy called Ian Bishop. Do you guys remember Ian Bishop?
I remember him.
I'm a straight guy. You ask any heterosexual West Ham fan, and they will still tell you they fell in love with Ian Bishop. He had long, flowing black hair, came past his shoulders. He looked like Jesus, right? And he used to just stand on the center circle and just ping, ping passes. He was like a cross between, I don't know, a Jan Molby from Liverpool or sort of Paul Scholes or, you know, someone in that Iniesta kind of. He would just ping passes. He was just so, he didn't run and he never tackled anybody, but he just ping passes. I loved him so, so much. And just recently I wrote a column, just to bring it full circle, about West Ham winning the Mickey Mouse Cup. I should say Mickey Mouse. Yeah. The very prestigious... very prestigious trophy. And I wrote something and he shared it. He shared it on Twitter and said it was a really nice column. So it was nice to bring it full circle. So yeah, Ian Bishop, we had Julian Dix, who was a monster. I once saw Julian Dix cut a player in two. I mean, he cut him in half from the waist. He was such a vicious, vicious player. But he had a left foot like a cannon. So, yeah, I mean, there was a terrible team, relegated twice, but just happy, happy memories of seeing my local team in a packed stadium every week, early days of the Premier League. It was magnificent. Just great.
Yeah. Upton Park, I remember, was a tough ground to go to.
Yeah.
It was a tight stadium. And it was difficult for Manchester United. We've had some ups and downs there. And
Don't jump. Don't jump over the ups and downs, you. I know what you're doing. I was there. All right. I was there. 1992. I know where you're going.
And
I had
95.
My season ticket. I was there. And the best thing about that game, all right, for those who don't know, everyone acknowledges that Man U lost the league at West Ham in 92 when they lost 1-0. Kenny Brown scored a fluke, a clearance hit him in the shin, flew off into the bottom corner past Schmeichel like a 20-yard rocket. Complete fluke. And the crowd went nuts because all through the game, Man U was singing to West Ham. I think it was Millwall. You know, West Ham hates Millwall, right?
Yeah.
So they were singing, "You're going down for the Millwall, down for the Millwall," because West Ham had already been relegated. That's what made it even better. They had already been relegated. They were bottom of the table. They were dead. They were gone. The odds of West Ham winning were ridiculous. And they beat Man U. They won 1-0 and they lost the title at West Ham. It was brilliant.
Yeah, for you.
It was almost worth the relegation.
Yeah, and also 95, where we lost the title after a draw. Ludek Miklosku having a worldie, playing a worldie, you know.
That was another one. That one was even better because then I was at Manchester. I was at university there, right? And it was just great. I mean, that whole period, I was so lucky looking back. I was at University of Manchester. You know, a working class kid from East London. I went to Manchester from 93 to 96. This is the absolute peak of the EPL explosion, number one. Mm. It's also the explosion of Britpop, number two.
Yeah.
So you've got Oasis and Blur and Pulp and Stone Roses, and it's all happening at the same time. Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. So I'm in Manchester, like you said, 1995. Near the end of my second year, and me and another friend, he was from Yorkshire, so he was massive Leeds United. Yeah. So it was a question of who hated Man U more, him or me, right? Because Leeds and Man U, no good, right?
Yeah.
But then Leeds and West Ham, no good. Everybody hates Leeds, right? So we go to this pub in Manchester and to see this game, West Ham against Man U, and Liverpool were playing Blackburn, right? And it was back and forth. West Ham go 1-0 up, which was ridiculous. And the goal was scored by Michael Hughes, who used to play for Manchester City, to make it even better. And like you said, Andy Cole cannot hit water if he fell out of a boat. He's missing everything, right? He's just missing. Ludek is saving everything. Meanwhile, just to make it even worse, Blackburn is losing. Yeah. Liverpool beat them. So, you know, Liverpool win. Ex-Man City player scores against Man U. It couldn't be better. Ludek Miklosko, he's saving everything. This pub is entirely Manchester United. And by the end of the second half, they're starting to throw beer glasses and this. It's getting a little bit ugly. So Brian in West McLeod. Ham... Yeah, so when West Ham score, I'm a bit like, and then my friend who's with me, he's Leeds. When Blackburn are, you know, winning the league, he's like, come on. Like, shh, shh, shh. Anyway, the final whistle goes, and we hold it in. But there's this idiot, a real sort of wealthy middle-class dickhead, who was a West Ham supporter. He had a jersey on, for Christ's sake. That tells you how stupid he was. So he has a West Ham jersey on in a Manchester pub on the last day of the season where Man U lose the title at West Ham, this dickhead starts singing "I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles" at the top of his voice. And even I am saying to my friend, he deserves to be punched. He actually deserves to be punched. We go out the pub about half an hour later. Sure enough, down the street, a couple of Man U fans are whacking him. Now, I do not approve of violence. But in this case, he kind of deserved it. I have to say, he kind of deserved it.
Yeah, happy day. Wrong place at wrong time.
I mean, you need to be smarter than that, man.
What's that?
I think you need to be smarter than that.
Oh, no street smarts. No street smarts. Funny.
And yes, the other memories I have of West Ham, of course, in the Premier League era is, you know, the talent that came through the West Ham Youth Academy, you know, Michael Carrick, Joe Cole, Jermaine Defoe, Rio Ferdinand, Frank Lampard. You know, that was also another memory I have of West Ham, Paolo Di Canio, not through the academy, but yeah, you know, one of the great West Ham players. Yeah, Trevor Sinclair, all these guys.
Great team. So, but
yeah, West Ham had some good teams.
They did. You're right. But only West Ham, could have that talent and still get relegated. Anybody else wins the league, they get relegated. Right. And I saw them. I was a journalist then. I was working for, I think, the Straits Times. No, not the Straits Times. I was working for Today newspaper. And whenever I'd have like a working holiday, it was great. I'd go back and see my family, and then I'd use the media to get, you know, press passes.
Yeah.
And I'd go and see as many games as I could. So I saw West Ham play Bolton, and it would have been around 2001. And I think that's when Glenn Roeder was the manager then. And a nice man, Glenn Roeder. I interviewed him. Lovely man. And you're right. That team that day was extraordinary. I mean, I think Defoe was still there. Di Canio was
Michael
still
Carrick
there.
As well. Yeah, Michael Carrick was.
All of them. Rio Ferdinand, Carrick. None of them. Or maybe Rio Ferdinand had left by then. But Carrick was still there. They were coming. Joe Cole was still there.
Yeah.
It was an extraordinary team. And yet it was 1-1 against Sam Allardyce's Bolton. And I think when Sam Allardyce, you know, when Allardyce's Bolton had the team, had the ball, I think it only touched the grass twice, if my memory serves. It was, we all had neck aches for the whole game. It was crap. And I just have two overriding memories of that game. One, like you said, or three, actually, three. One, how can a team that good, West Ham, be that bad? Two, this is really childish, but when I interviewed Sam Allardyce, he was like this close. And the whole time I just kept thinking, you have the biggest head I have ever seen on a human being, which is a stupid, childish observation because I've got a big head too. But it was like, my God, that's like a beach ball. And I just couldn't stop looking at this man's enormous head. And three, bringing it kind of full circle, my childhood hero at West Ham was a guy called Trevor Brooking, absolute legend. Just one of the greatest players to ever play for West Ham or England. Ended up becoming director of football for England for a while. And he was then a director at West Ham. And he happened to be in the press box with me doing something. And we made small talk. And this is my hero. This is my childhood hero. And I start following him out of the press box. And so he assumes that I'm a VIP like him. And so he starts going up these stairs. I don't know where I'm going at Upton Park, but we're still talking. And it turns out he's going into a private VIP executive suite with lots of other really important, famous people like politicians and whatever, whatever. And I follow him in like an idiot. So I'm going in and he's opening the door open for me thinking, who is this dickhead? Why is he here? And so I had to just gently let this hero, Sir Trevor Brooking, walk away. And then I sort of went, okay, bye. Idiots.
Well, you got to pick into the VIP room, that's something.
Oh, yeah. I got humiliated in West Ham. Yeah, but right. So let's Upton Park VIP. This will make you laugh. So you go to the press box at Old Trafford. I haven't been there for a while, but Old Trafford was like a hotel buffet. They've got all this food out for the journalists. Three-course meal, they bring out desserts. Seriously, they have a menu. alcohol. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. The journalists get spoiled. And Stamford Bridge, even better. What an experience. So I remember I went to Old Trafford and I was, you know, wined and dined. And then the following week, I went to Upton Park and it was one old uncle cutting up cheese sandwiches. It was like something out of a Senkung CC, right? It was an old uncle. One old uncle. He was about 70 plus and he was pouring like flat lemonade and flat Coca-Cola out of a cheap 2-liter bottle. And it was flat, right? And then cutting up these stale white bread cheese sandwiches like a Senkung CC. That's the difference between West Ham and Man U.
Okay. Moving on from West Ham, generally in the era, in the Premier League era of the 90s and the noughties, let's speak about players, the players that impressed you the most.
Look, I am biased, as I think you probably are, but maybe it's age, maybe it's nostalgia. But I do look back at that 90s period, particularly, and the early 2000s, but particularly the mid to late 90s, as really special for the EPL. Really special for a few reasons. One, I think it had an element of innocence still about it. It was wealthy, but it's not like it is now. It's not obscene wealth. So that was one. And two, there was still a neighborhood, not kampong, but a neighborhood feel to some of the teams and players. So every team had like three or four homegrown players. Every team. Because they didn't, back then it was glamorous if you had like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer a Norwegian or a Swede. It was Lundberg. It was really exciting. You know, I remember Newcastle when they got that fella. What was his name?
Asprilla.
It was like an alien. It was unbelievable. Yeah. So every team, West Ham would have Joe Cole and Michael Carrick and so on. And Man U would have the class of 92. Liverpool would have the local boys. But, you know, Southampton would have Matt Le Tissier and Alan Shearer. And Newcastle would have all these great local boys. And every team had a core of solid pros that made it kind of a little bit more relatable. Now it's just like the United Nations. If I'm being honest, it's just like watching the United Nations. It's great. It's fine. But
it's like watching a World 11 play.
Yeah, and that's fun. There's nothing wrong with that. But there was something about watching, a guy like Ian Bishop do something special or Joe Cole, because he's one of your own. And, you know, they make such a big deal now about Mark Noble. But that's because he's a dinosaur. That doesn't happen anymore. And it's also because he wasn't really good enough to go anywhere else, but no one ever says that. But so players, right. I love Matt Le Tissier. I adored Matt Le Tissier. I loved the way he played. I loved his attitude. I loved Di Canio. And I have to say, I was obsessed with the man, with the king, Eric Cantona. I still am. I still say this objectively, that I think the coolest two players, in my humble opinion, that have ever played in English football were both of Man U. They were Eric Cantona and George Best. To me, those two guys, they're it. Everybody else is playing catch up. And I was at Manchester University, living in this shitty student house. And I remember coming home from wherever, lectures, and the girl we were staying with said, "You have to see the news." Why? Wait, because she'd already seen it. Wait till you see what Eric Cantona has done.
Oh.
I thought he'd scored a spectacular goal or something, you know, Crystal Palace, Selhurst Park. I thought, oh, all right. And she didn't tell us. She didn't tell us. She just said, it's on the news at 10, which is, you know, news at 10. Why is Cantona's goal on the news? She said, just watch. So we sat down and, oh, my God, I can still remember that. Like nobody had ever seen anything like it before.
Yeah,
and the fact that A, he was taken out a racist, and B, 25, 30 years later, he still hasn't apologized, and he still says he'd do it again, and he still has no regrets. And he's loved even more.
Yeah, after that. Yeah.
He's the man. I love Cantona. I still do love Cantona. He's the one player I'd love to meet, but I think I'd be a bit intimidated. I love Cantona.
Yeah. True, me too. My favorite Manchester United player as well, all time, after Lee Sharp.
No, oh, yeah, I've met Lee Sharp. He's a character. He's funny. Yeah, he's a good lad.
I've met him as well in Singapore, so that's nice. Underrated players in that era who you felt, you know, was really good but didn't get too much credit.
Well, it sounds silly now, and I'm going to sound like a real cliche because so many people have said this. I still think that Paul Scholes was underrated. I know everybody says, no, he wasn't. He really, really was. Even by me, I didn't fully appreciate how good he was until much later when you look back and you realize what you've lost. But I think he wasn't appreciated.
It's like the same thing, like you don't know what you got until it's gone.
Yeah. And I remember 2001, I covered Man U's tour of Singapore and Malaysia. And I was in KL and watching the Bukit Jalil, watching the training session. And look, again, cliche, but we know how good they are. But the thing is, when they're all roughly equally good, they tend to cancel themselves out because they're all playing at a similar level, right? Mm. So the old joke is, if you take the most average EPL footballer and you drop him into a team at Farrer Park or Bishan Park, he will look like a freak. He will look like, and even Wout Weghorst, you drop Wout Weghorst into any Bishan Park team, he will look like Messi, right? Because the golf is... But when they're all the same, it's hard to spot. So when you watch them up close in training, then you see it. Because I remember watching Juan Sebastian Veron had just joined Man U. He was the big signing. So we were all watching him. And I can remember this like it was yesterday. There was him, Nicky Butt, and Paul Scholes. And they were pinging passes to each other in the way that you or I would shoot. You know, if we took a penalty and we stroked the ball as hard as we possibly could, I'm telling you, that's how hard they were passing to each other. They were like shooting at each other. Every one of them in like a triangle, and they were 40-yard passes in a triangle. Every one of them was trapping it on their chest or on their instep and smashing it back again. None of them had to move from their position. They didn't have to move a step to the left or a step to the right. It just nailed their chest or their instep. And they're firing these passes. To see that level of talent up close and to see Paul Scholes basically doing this with his eyes closed, I think he's the one. When I look back at that so-called golden generation, Lampard and Gerrard and all that, I find that a bit cliched. They were your proverbial English box-to-box, socks round the ankles, run all day, big engines, all the cliches. Great players, don't get me wrong. Terrific players. But I believe you drop Paul Scholes into Barcelona, Juventus, Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, put him alongside Zidane, it's different.
He can just do things
that other people couldn't do.
I think the only thing underrated about Scholes is his tackle. His tackles are...
His tackles were hilarious. Yeah, he couldn't tackle.
They couldn't.
So it didn't matter. You know, I mean,
actually, there's this thing about Scholes that people do not know was that when he broke into the United first team, he was actually a forward. I remember Scholes playing up front with Andy Cole and Cantona. Yeah, Cantona being playing in a playmaking position. So I remember Scholes playing as a center forward first, and then suddenly he became a midfielder, and then the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, so Paul Scholes for me, but at a lower level, because I'm biased, I still say Ian Bishop. I still say Ian Bishop was one of the best players not to play for England. He was a fantastic footballer. Loved him.
All right, now overrated player.
Overrated player. You've caught me on the spot here. Overrated player. It depends. Let me think about this. It depends how you... If I talk about West Ham for a moment, Di Canio could be overrated because he would disappear. If the conditions were not in his favour, famously, there was one season he was injured almost every single time West Ham played away. He would not play away games. So he was very temperamental. So he would be magnificent at Upton Park. But then he would go away to the cliched wet Wednesday night at Stoke type of game and completely disappear. So I wouldn't say he was overrated, is a bit unfair, but sometimes infuriating to see that contrast every week. Yeah, that was tough. I would say the, looking back at it now, let me think. I would say the England team was overrated.
The whole England team.
Because I covered the tournament in 2004 in Portugal, the Euros.
Euro 2004, yeah, okay.
When Wayne Rooney broke through, I was there for that. And again, the annoying thing, to me, England is like Star Wars, or it's like, it's not the product that's annoying, it's the fans around them that's annoying, like Star Wars, right? Yeah. Because if you look at England, the hype and the media and the fans around them, you know, it's coming home. It drives you mad. And when you cover international tournaments, I shouldn't say this, but sometimes I find it a bit embarrassing as an Englishman myself. I just find it a bit embarrassing. Every tournament they think they're going to win. And they say, no, we don't. But they do, because the EPL gets carried away and best league in the world, therefore best national team in the world. They've never really looked like winning. Weirdly, because I think when they had a good squad, they've never had the right manager. So Sven-Göran Eriksson, terrible, absolutely terrible. He should have done better with that team, but he was completely in awe of the whole celebrity, the cult of celebrity. I think David Beckham was essentially running the dressing room. So too many egos, too many personalities, too many cliques. That's been acknowledged. You had the Liverpool boys here, the Man U boys here. So I give credit to Gareth Southgate. He's changed all that. This is by far, in my opinion, the most likable England team. But they're never going to win. That England team, and I've said this every tournament, I think Gareth Southgate is a lovely man, the kind man, empathetic man. They're never going to win. If he's in charge of that team for 10 tournaments, they will come home without a trophy for 10 tournaments. They will never, never win, because he'll always be too cautious. And in the 90s, more so the 2000s, I wouldn't say England were too cautious, but it was the opposite. They were too devoted to the celebrities. Beckham was never dropped. Rooney was never dropped. Owen was never dropped. They were clearly not fit in several of those tournaments. You know, the famous...
He was injured, I think.
Yeah, metatarsal.
Yeah.
A bold manager would have said, sorry, you can come along, but I'm playing A, B, and C. Right. So, yeah, I would say the England team was quite overrated.
Yeah, okay. Talking about England team, in terms of international tournaments in that period of time, the 90s and the noughties, which was the most memorable one for you?
Well, it's a bit like West Ham. That's also ironic, because my most memorable tournament was probably the most crap, which was Italia 90, because I was the right age. I was 15, and I had this, the first kind of out-of-body orgasmic, there's no other way of saying it, I had my first orgasmic experience as a football fan. You know, 14, 15 years old, this predates sex and women and everything else, but this was clearly the closest thing to it. And it was 1990, England Belgium, last minute of extra time. It's going to penalties. Gascoigne wins the free kick, then he clips over an absolutely perfect ball, and then famously David Platt does the whole swivel, hits it on the volley, and it's just a brilliant goal, last minute. It's a Hollywood script. He buries it in the far corner. And I'm a 15-year-old in my bedroom. And I tell you, it was an orgasm. It was just this whole... I'd never, ever felt anything like it watching football. And I don't honestly think I have since, just because of the age I was, you know, 15, perfect age. What was at stake? Last minute of quarterfinal of the World Cup?
Yeah.
Just everything. Was it quarterfinal or whatever it was? But anyway, it was knockout stages.
Quarterfinals, you played Cameroon.
Correct. And they weren't very good in that game either. So that's a great example, because everyone's got memories of the 90 World Cup. Gazza's tears, Lineker doing the whole have a word with him.
Yeah.
Gazza's famous yellow card, Stuart Pearce penalty. There are so many memories. But if I watched a documentary recently, and if you take the World Cup as a whole, it really wasn't very good.
Yeah, it was.
Argentina were awful, like spectacularly awful, really cynical and violent. And the final was
dirty. Yeah,
I can't remember a worse one, because it was really violent. If you remember, Argentina had loads of yellow cards, and I think there was a red card, and they were just kicking Germany. There was a
lot of rolling around, yeah.
Just kicking Germany. It was terrible. And I do believe if England had got to the final, they would have won. But that was me with the standout. And the other one, of course, would have been 96. Hmm. Euro 96. You know, football's coming home. Three Lions. Good England team. Terry Venables. Good manager, Terry Venables.
Yeah.
One of the best England's had. Very underrated. Good manager. Yeah. And he's from my hometown as well.
Okay.
Good manager, good team, likable team, played lovely football. Of that whole period, I think I'd go even further. I'd even go into the 2000s. I think that short period that Venable had that team, 94 to 96, that was the most attractive football they played, I think. Mm. It was just great. Because you had Gazza, you had Shearer at his peak, you had Sheringham. Gary Neville. Anderton, you had Anderton, McManaman. Spurs, great winger. Great team.
McManaman, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Getting back to Italia 90 first, I was a bit too young for that World Cup, but from that World Cup, I got educated by my father. So he always would tell me, do not support the Argentinians, do not support the Germans because they're dirty. They'll be rolling on the ground, a bit of touch, and they'll be falling on the floor and rolling about. And I remember he bought me this Sabutio. Mm. A Sabutio stat, and in that there were two teams. So there's one team in blue and one team in stripes, light blue stripes. So he would have been delighted I didn't choose the team in the light blue stripes. So then that's how Italy became my team when it came to the national, all these World Cups and Euros and all, and I started supporting Italy. Mm. So, and also that point where you say that England, if they had made it to the final, they could have won it. I would have wanted to ask you that as well. Do you think England would have won the World Cup had they made it to the final? But that was also against a very good Germany team that they played in the semi-finals.
It was, but they were so close to beating Germany. Ironically, that was probably...
I think England hit the bar or post or something.
Waddle hit the post. Yeah. I think Germany did as well. I think Germany hit the woodwork. But they got better and better in that game. And it was arguably England's best performance. That and probably the Holland game, which actually drew, I think, 0-0. No, 1-0, 0-0. But that was England's best complete performance. If Gazza, you can't say, because I don't think England without Gazza wins. No way. But and he got the yellow card. But Gazza, an England with Gazza, yes, I think they would have beaten Argentina. The best team in the tournament was Germany. And they almost beat them. There was nothing in it, just penalties. I think they would have beaten Argentina. Yeah.
Yeah. And also Euro 96, I think that was I don't support England too often, but in 96, I think I was really behind England. I thought they would finally win something. I'd agree with you. They played really well in that tournament. It looked like it was coming home for real this time, but unfortunately, it's the Germans again, right? In the semis and the penalty shootout again. And I remember Andres Müller's celebration after scoring his penalty.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, believe it or not, this is not that surprising. But if you talk to a lot of English football fans, that might have changed now, but certainly of my generation, we're not that big on England. It's club football first. People sometimes don't get this. You ask most football fans, your team to win the league or England to win the World Cup? My generation, I believe, most would say my club to win the league or the Champions League or whatever. So it's not a love-hate relationship, but it is a bit, because I grew up with the period of football hooliganism and it was crap and England was shit and they had a terrible reputation, and rightly so. They everywhere they went, they were fighting and smashing up the town centre, and they were just so unlikable. So I've always had a bit of a, not love-hate, but a kind of indifference. And I'll say this, in the Euros, the recent one, 2020, played in 21, when they played Italy in the final, I wanted Italy to win.
Thank you.
Well, it wasn't for you, but not for you personally. But it was just because I was just fed up with the behaviour of the fans. You remember what happened beforehand, right? They were violence in the streets, sticking flares up their arse and there was cocaine everywhere, and they were storming into Wembley, all of which, incidentally, you notice has been conveniently forgotten. No one seems to talk about it anymore in the British media. They stormed into Wembley in the final. But you notice if this had been Italy or Germany or Belgium, we'd still be talking about it, right? Yep. But for some reason, because it's England,
So if it's not Gareth Southgate for you, you say he's too cautious, which would be the ideal manager for the current crop of players playing right now? I mean, they have decent players. Technically, they are pretty decent. But which manager do you think that they can actually take that step further?
Well, there's the two obvious choices, aren't there? I think Pep Guardiola or Jurgen Klopp. They win the World Cup. England wins the World Cup with either of those managers. And if you can't get them, get David Moyes. And he can bore them to death.
What are the chances of a Scottish man managing England?
No, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. The same for a German, I guess.
Yeah, we had enough problems with the Swede and the Italian.
But, talking about Sven-Goran Eriksson, he actually did very well in Serie A. But I think, as you said, I feel the celebrity status of being the first foreign England manager, I think that got to him. Because he didn't get that kind of treatment, of course, in Serie A. And that, you know, that it was high-pressure situation in Serie A. You either win or you get sacked. That kind of a situation that he was living in day-to-day. He did well, won trophies with Lazio, and there was quite a good period of time where he had with Lazio and he won a lot. But yeah, in England, I think he just got to his head and he started looking elsewhere as well, right? As reports were to believe.
And don't underestimate also how big the celebrity circus had become. By 2006, it was at its absolute peak of wags. I think also, I personally believe that the peak of the EPL was about that time. I kind of think it's dipped a bit. Not dipped in terms of, it's still very popular. But because what happened, as you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s, the reason the EPL became what it is, there's three reasons actually. One, it's in English, which straight away puts it at an advantage of every other league, right? For Asia and Africa and other parts of the world. That's number one. Two, it coincided with the explosion of the internet. So you've got the big, and three, putting it all together, cable television. So for the first time in Southeast Asia, we got live football at the same time we got the internet in a sport that's in a language that many of us understand. So it all comes together in the early 2000s. And then you happen to get a spectacularly good-looking man like David Beckham, who's also brilliant at football, who also plays for the world's biggest club, who also happened to produce a core of young footballers that they've never done since the Busby Babes and probably won't happen again. It just all came together at the right time. Then he marries a Spice Girl, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So you get to 2006. And honestly, David Beckham and that celebrity is bigger than England. It's bigger than Sven-Göran Eriksson. And I don't care what anybody says. I think Eriksson fell for it. He allowed the, you remember the 2006, there were wives everywhere. Yeah. He shouldn't have allowed any of that. He should not have allowed any of that. Even Gary Neville says today it was wrong. It was a circus. It was a circus. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think the whole job just completely overwhelmed Eriksson. So what happened was they go the complete opposite. They realize they need discipline. So they go with Capello, which is too far the other way. The man doesn't communicate. He doesn't speak to them. He doesn't talk to them. He doesn't call them. He doesn't do anything. There's no rapport. There's no empathy. There's no communication. There's no camaraderie. There's nothing. So they all hate him. Yeah, they all have. You got all players retiring and like was it Carragher and Scholes.
Capello was over the hill. He wasn't moving on in time. He's still stuck in his old rut.
Yeah.
At that time. And also, okay, getting back to the Premier League, this question for you. Bring to the end part one of looking back to the 90s and noughties with Neil Humphreys. Look out for part two coming out soon.